Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today is Stephen Verdilli. He is from New York City and works for NBC. He is also the creator of the disability satire site, The Squeaky Wheel. So we'll talk all about all of that. Stephen, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Kevin.
Oh, man, great to have you. I know it's been a minute since we talked in person, and we were actually on a panel together at the SMA conference years ago. So definitely good to have you on the show today, and looking forward to it. So before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of a treatment for SMA. Whether you are living with SMA or are the parent to a child with SMA, make a choice today that could impact your future. Visit treatmysma.com to see why treatment matters.
Okay, so Stephen, to start out, can you just tell listeners just about your story and when you were diagnosed with SMA? We'll start there.
Sure. So I was diagnosed with SMA just a few days after I was born, as I had an older sister who had SMA. So I knew it was sort of in the blood. And I was tested when I was born. I showed symptoms around when I was 2 years old. I've been using a power wheelchair ever since then. And I've been involved with Pure SMA and what was formerly Families of SMA for my entire life, and I'm excited to be here.
That's awesome. And having an older sibling who also had SMA, how did that kind of impact you? And were you able to kind of like learn in that respect?
Yeah, so when we were younger, my sister and I, we did sort of everything together. It was really sort of helpful having that growing up to sort of have a sibling who was in a similar situation. We went to the same school and we went to summer camp together. We really did a lot of the sort of SMA activities, all the fundraisers and things like that. It was very nice.
Sure, sure. And growing up, so I know you work in the entertainment industry now. Was that something you were interested in early on as a kid, or what were your main interests?
I would say not too much as a kid. I was always really interested in sort of technology and working on the computer. I was sort of very computer savvy for a little kid. I liked sort of these design art programs for children. And then by the time I was maybe 13 or 14, I was getting really into Photoshop and all the sort of graphics software. And that was what eventually led me to decide to go to school for graphic design after I had graduated high school. It was something that I was really excited to sort of learn more about and to really dive deeper into.
That's awesome. And let's talk about that for a minute. So when you made the transition to college, because I know now, you know, you live independently, you have a full team of caregivers, but what was that initial transition like for you when you first started managing caregivers? Was it college or was it before that?
So I always had sort of home health aides and nurses and things like that as a kid growing up, but it wasn't really sort of the 24-hour-a-day, full-time dependent version of it because I was around my family so much. And it wasn't until I went to college that I really had to worry about, you know, staffing 24 hours a day, making sure that I always had someone around who could help me if I needed. And it was definitely challenging for a while to find people that not only were available and could sort of make the schedule work, but people who I was comfortable with, and sort of managing that while also being a first semester BFA student is sort of very difficult because you have your mind in two different worlds at the same time in terms of how am I gonna write this paper tonight and then how am I going to get up in the morning? It's a sort of a challenging thing to balance. And I'd say for probably the first year or two of college, there was a lot of turnover and people coming and going. I sort of had a mix of different people on my care team. And then by my junior year, I had a more reliable, sort of stable team of people, which really allowed me to sort of put my head down and focus all on school, because I didn't have to worry about that as much. And I was able to do internships. I was able to really focus on my classes. And almost everybody that started working with me then is the same people who are working with me now, about 5 years later, which is great.
That's really cool, because I mean, for listeners, many know that I had the same caregiver for 7 years, but I know how rare that is. And to have a team like that for that long, that's a really cool relationship to build.
Definitely.
That's awesome. And also, I forgot to ask, so where are you, because I know you're in New York now, where are you from originally, and then where did you go to college?
Sure. So I've always been in New York. I grew up in Long Island, out in Suffolk County, out east. Then when I went to college, I lived in the dorms at St. John's University, which is a sort of big university in Queens, New York. And now I live in Manhattan, in the city. So I've been bouncing around the different areas of New York, but always been here.
That's really cool. And I imagine, so you went to school for graphic design, and then that kind of led you into where you are now. Can you talk about that and your career trajectory, how you ended up at NBC?
Sure. So one of the things that I started in my very first 2 weeks of college was joining the university newspaper, the St. John's Torch. And I started out as a designer for them, and I wanted to sort of just find some sort of club, some social recreational activity where I could put my graphic design skills to use, because I knew that it was going to be a few semesters before I was even taking those graphic design classes. I was so excited to just be on Photoshop and be in the computer already. So I joined the newspaper. I made some really great friends there. And throughout all 4 years while I was there, I was really heavily involved in the Torch. And most of my friends from the newspaper were journalists and journalism majors. And they were all looking at these internships at CBS and New York Times and NBC. And I thought it was super cool. And they were, you know, trying to encourage me to apply to these different places that they were applying to. I had, I believe, three friends at the time who were all interning at NBC. And they were like, this program is great. Like, you know, make sure your portfolio is tip-top shape and then send in as many applications as you can and really do your work to try and get in, because once you're in, it's a fun place to work, and we could, you know, intern over the summer together. And I was really a big fan of television and comedy and film, and I was like, you know, maybe that's a different side of the company that I could intern for. So I applied to all the TV networks, and I ended up interning the summer of my junior year for the Oxygen Network. At the time, they were sort of rebranding and transitioning from a women's lifestyle TV network to what it is now, which is a true crime television network. There's a big overlap in audience of sort of women's programming and true crime. And I got to spend the summer working with them as they rebranded and worked on some really cool work around the New York City subway system and all these different digital things that were going on for their rebranding. And then once I worked there, I had so much fun, I decided to try and apply to intern again during my senior year. And I applied and ended up interning as a designer with the corporate team. And I interned there my senior year. I was fortunate enough that a job opened just as I was finishing up my internship as I was graduating. I took 1 week off for my college graduation, and the next week off, I started my job, and I've been there for about 4 years now as an employee.
That's really awesome. And I mean, especially going from college to a company like that, it's, I mean, what was kind of your feelings going to a corporation that big, managing a full-time job, along with everything about life with SMA, what was kind of the biggest, the steps you had to take to go from college to that?
There was a lot. I remember when I was first sort of transitioning from being a student and an intern and then ready to work there full time, I realized that my internships were only 2, sometimes 3 days a week. I was like, right now I'm going to have to be doing this commute 5 days a week. And I'm going to be losing my dorm in Queens. And I was moving back to Long Island, which is about another 45 minutes further. So it went from being an hour and a half commute to a 2.5 hour commute. And very quickly, I was like, this is not sustainable. I'm going to be way too exhausted. So probably within 2 or 3 weeks of working there, commuting every day from Long Island, I went to my manager and I said, look, you know, I love working here. I really want to make this work and I want to be a full-time employee. Is there any way I can work sort of partially remote just for about a month until I can find an apartment in Manhattan where I would be close and wouldn't have to be doing this 2.5 hour commute every day? They were really flexible with me and it allowed me to sort of work hybrid for those few weeks. As I found a place, I found a apartment one day. I looked at like 13 or 14 different apartments in one day all around Manhattan, put in an offer, and I was moving in the next week. So it moved very quickly. It was a little bit faster than I planned, but it was such a good opportunity that I couldn't pass up, and I had to take advantage of it.
And what is it like apartment hunting in New York in terms of accessibility? Because I know it's different wherever you go, but was that a challenge or were you able to find something? Fair. I mean, I found it relatively quickly, but still.
Yeah, so I'd say the sort of unfortunate thing about accessible apartments in New York City is that they're usually the luxury apartments, which are quite expensive. If you're looking for what they call an elevator building, which is the kind of building we want, they usually have a doorman and they have staff and things like that that tend to be luxury amenities that can be expensive. So there is certainly no shortage of accessible apartments, but there is a extreme shortage of affordable accessible apartments. And it was just a matter of finding one that checked all the boxes that sort of was within distance. I really wanted to find something that was within walking distance, just so I wouldn't have to rely on public transportation, which is not the most accessible. I certainly do take the subway and I ride the bus all the time, but I didn't really want it to be an everyday thing if I could avoid it. And I was able to find an apartment that was just within my budget, had an elevator, and was within the walking distance of where I work. So that was exciting.
That's really awesome. And yeah, I know that's kind of the biggest step. And it is crazy that, yeah, the expense goes up when you're looking for basic accommodations, but that's really cool. Well, Zeeman, we'll get back in just a minute, talk about Squeaky Wheel and just some more topics. But before we do that, if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by Genentech, the makers of a treatment for SMA. If you are living with SMA, the subtle changes that happen from one day to the next can be hard to notice until a key function is lost. Many people find that these changes can impact their life, not just physically, but also emotionally. Since the progression of SMA is relentless, taking action now is important. If you've waited to go on treatment or were told there were no treatments for you, now might be the time to talk to your doctor. Breakthroughs in science have led to more options than ever before in treatment and care. Choosing a disease-modifying treatment can make a difference. Why wait? Visit treatmysma.com to see why treatment matters.
Okay, so as I mentioned in the intro, in addition to your full-time job, you created last year the disability satire site, The Squeaky Wheel, which is essentially the Onion for disabled people. And for those who read my column, you might know that I actually write for it as well. And so it's a really cool community. So Stephen, I just wanted to ask you when that idea kind of came to you and how you got the site started.
Sure. So I can say probably about a year after I started working full time, was living in the city, I just became really sort of interested in trying to take my creative skill set and my experiences from the newspaper and from college and from NBC and all these freelance design jobs I had done, and try and think about how I could combine that sort of creative background and my interest in comedy and TV with my experience of having a disability. Because I've never really worked with other disabled people. I've never really done work around disability or focused on it, anything like that. And I was like, this is silly. This is certainly my sort of one of the biggest experiences I have. And it's one that is pretty unique. So it's silly to not be trying to think creatively about that. And what I started doing is brainstorming all these little projects. I was trying to write short films and short stories and sort of working in all these different mediums. And what I kept finding was that the format that I knew was writing for the newspaper, which was this very different voice than the sort of creative fiction narrative style. And my articles sounded almost, or my stories, I should say, at the time, were sounding almost like sarcastic and sort of mocking the stuff we see in real life. And that was when it clicked in my head. Maybe it's not a short film. Maybe it's a satire story or a satire website. And then as soon as I had that idea, I wrote probably the first 20 stories in maybe 3 or 4 weeks. I was banging them out fast and really just trying to get a lot of content together to validate the idea that I had. I hadn't shown anybody the work at this point. It was all just to myself, and I was really sort of head down writing as much as I could, trying to figure out what the voice is and what the audience is and sort of what the speaky reel could be. And once I put it all together, I threw it up online. The first person I showed was my girlfriend, and I was like, does it make sense? Do you think it works? And she thought, absolutely, like, it made perfect sense off the bat. And I talked with her for a few days about sort of, should I post these online? What do you think? What's the best angle? And I just found a lot of positive reception right away, which is really encouraging and sort of encouraged me to keep writing and to start recruiting more writers, to open up the social media platforms. Those didn't exist at that point. And since then, it's grown pretty quickly. Like you said, it's been, I would say, just over a full year. And we now have coming up on 150 articles total and over 20 people who have written stories for us. So certainly grown.
That's really cool. And I love the trajectory there. And I should mention too, I mean, listeners probably know, but I also worked for the school paper throughout college, and it does really ignite that creativity in you, and that a lot of people have that yearning for satire, and I love that it's expanded into, like, the idea of the Onion has expanded to disability, and then there's like the Broadway Beat, which is the Onion for theater nerds, you know, and there's all these different publications out there. But so leaning to my next question, between working full-time, doing the squeaky wheel, kind of like, what's kind of your strategy for managing all of that and you know, and having enough time to do both your main career and your creative outlets?
Yeah, so I mean, it's certainly challenging to keep up with both. Fortunately, I find that since the pandemic, I've been sort of hybrid, working from home a few days a week and going into the office a few days a week. And that sort of preserves a little bit of the energy so I can be productive in the evenings and at night working on Speaky Reel. And part of it is just when it's something fun, it doesn't feel like work. It never feels tiresome to write Speaky Reel stories just because I'm always laughing and just enjoying the process of it. So it's a matter of enjoying what you do. I always told myself that the minute I stop wanting to write the stories, I'm going to stop writing the stories because I don't want it to feel like a chore. And there's months where I've written 10 and months where I've written one. And it's just a matter of my time. And while I was out sick, I was posting in the group chat and everyone else was sort of going overboard and writing extra to make up for it. And that was awesome. And things have really been rolling. It's a matter of working with the team. I'm trying to make sure that the speaker reel is something that is sustainable and doesn't just depend on me, but is really a full team of people. That way it sort of runs itself.
Absolutely. I mean, I can speak, being a part of it, it's definitely a very collaborative effort. And that's how any publication runs. So that's really cool.
Definitely. It goes back to the school newspaper vibe that we were talking about originally. One fun anecdote that you reminded me of when you were saying that was that I remembered when I was on the school newspaper, every year we would sort of meet the first week of the year to talk about what could we do differently this year. And my idea was always to make a satire issue of the university newspaper. And it got rejected every year. And I was like, once I graduated, I knew I was going to find my way back to that and made it happen.
I was about to say, I mean, I'm sure your colleagues then know what you're doing now, but that's kind of like, hey, I eventually made it happen. But
yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, and they're big supporters of it. They're still my friends today. They're great.
That's awesome. We actually, well, at ours, we had once a year satire publication, but it was about our rival school. So I went to NC State and it was about UNC and it was called their paper is called the Daily Tar Heel. So ours is called the Daily Tar Hell. Like once a year. So like, yeah, it went back and forth, but satire is just something that, and I think especially for the disability community, I love that you brought it too, because like you said, there's a limited amount of disability representation in media to begin with, but particularly in the realm of comedy, that's what really helps elevate our stories and make people. And the funny thing, I mean I've written stories there and we ran others where people didn't know it was satire, and which I think is really telling about the state of just like, you know, the discrimination we face and the ableist issues. It's hard to even like distinguish truth from fiction. And I think that's what makes it so unique, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. I think disability in media is something that is seen so differently by non-disabled people than it is by us. We sort of see the inspiration porn and these sort of very basic stories that come up year after year. And it feels like a joke, like it feels tropey, and it feels like something that's very easy to make fun of. And that's why the stories come so easy to us, because the state of representation, as you said, isn't really all that great. And that's what gives us our material. And that's why satire is such a good format to joke about disability.
Absolutely. And Stephen, can you talk just about your daily life? So for a typical day of the week, what does it look like between work, managing care, relationships, etc.?
Sure. So I live in the city with my girlfriend. I still have usually someone come who helps me out in the morning, and they stay most of the day while I'm working. And then they'll usually leave in the afternoon, and I have someone else who comes at night who helps me get ready for bed. I do all my speaky real work in the evening. I try to relax on the weekends and not do too much work, but I do usually do a little bit on Saturday and Sunday. And then because we live in the city, I'm always trying to go to comedy shows and go to theater. I probably try and go see a show about once a week just to get out, whether it's something cheap, something free in the park, or whether it's something big on Broadway, just trying to experience everything that I can while I get to live in the middle of such a cool city.
Definitely the city that never sleeps. I've been several times and it lives up to the hype for sure.
Absolutely. I love the city. I don't ever see myself leaving. I love it here. It's quite fun.
That's awesome. And Stephen, just wrapping up here, do you have any advice for particularly other listeners with SMA. And, you know, this episode is going to go out in August, which is SMA Awareness Month. Do you have, you know, with your experience in both working, managing care, in relationships, what's something you want to say to the community out there?
Sure. I think a lot of it just becomes about prioritizing sort of what's important and then thinking about sort of what you need to get to that place of achieving what you're aiming for. I knew as soon as I started living at college, I liked living independently. And I knew that that meant sort of having a reliable, expansive care team. And I spent all my energy on that for probably, like I said, the first year or two of college, just to make it something that was sort of sustainable and lasted. And then once I was able to do that, you're able to build on it. And then I was able to focus on my internships. And I put all my energy into that. And then once I had my internship, I was aiming for a job and I put all my energy into that. And as soon as I got the job, I was putting my energy into finding an apartment. And it's sort of just this cumulative thing of, as long as you build things sustainably and you think long-term, you can come up with, you know, a really nice life and something that hopefully achieves all the goals that you're trying to. I'm certainly very fortunate and grateful for all the things I've been able to do over the last few years. It's certainly still challenging, and the challenges don't go away, but you get better at them over time. And I think that's really the main thing I learned, is that build things sustainably so that you can build upon them and keep going further.
That's great. That's great. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for coming on today. And so listeners can find The Squeaky Wheel at thesqueakywheel.com and also on all social media pages. Where else can they find you and more about your work?
And sure. So you can find me on Instagram at Stephen Verdilli Creative. Or if you want to check out my work, you can go to stephenverdilli.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Stephen, thank you so much again. And for our listeners out there, you can find more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on our forums and social media, and visit smanewstoday.com for all the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.